My name's Dave and I'm an alcoholic. I'll just do a quick bit of housekeeping first. I might have smoking outside and can use the sun bucket provided for the bus. The fire exits, one at the front and one at the back. And the toilet facilities outside the back door to the right. There's also a facility in the main house by the refectory downstairs. And I now invite Dudley here to read the preamble. Thank you, Dudley.
Yeah, my name is Dudley. I'm an alcoholic. The AA preamble. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety.
Thank you, Dudley. Would like to join me in a moment of silence, please, to remember why we're here today. And for the still suffering alcoholic, both inside and outside these rooms. Thanks, everybody. And now I'd like to introduce our fifth old timer for today, which is Dudley. Home group is Tuesday lunchtime at Ascot. Dudley's chaplain John was the first old timer who came across. I'm told, and first London in central London was sure they first meet, is that correct? Sure. Okay, Dudley, as you place the mic in the correct position, and then we'll add to his share. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ryan. Well, my name is Dudley, I'm an alcoholic. And, yes, my first person I met in AA in this country was a man called Shetland John, and it was in about 1965, round about the September of it, that I met him. And I had made my big geographical change from the little island where I was born in Barbados in the West Indies, and I had been having a problem with drink. I had I had tried to go to AA in Barbados in those days. I mean, I was trying to find out what's wrong with me, and I have to give you a little run about myself, the background. I come from, by Barbadian standards, a middle class family. My father's a headmaster, and the reason I mentioned these things is that I grew up in a very, very respectable Christian family. My father was a bachelor of arts in classics, because he attended the Codrington College in Barbados, which in those days was an affiliate of Durham University, and did read classics and so on. And so I grew up, you know, with that the headmaster's son, and we were a Christian family, an acolyte until I was 17, you know, and we were a close-knit family, one of four children. My mother had dyslipidemia sclerosis and couldn't walk. Like, I only remember seeing her walking on one occasion in my life. But because we were such a close-knit Christian family, you know, I didn't know anything different. And people would say, you know, it must be terrible when their mother's ill. But we didn't know anything different to that. And because of the illness, we were driven together as a family. And it is important, because I know my alcoholism pulled me away from that tightly knit family. Because when I left school in around about the early 1960, I had to be away from this close-knit family to work in the job that I was doing with Kevin Wise as a trainee telegraphist and so on. And I was away from this family, and that was the beginning of that close-knit family net that I left. And I fell into drinking because having been brought up in that sort of respectable Christian family, you know, I had my problems about being a man, and I went to work in a big cable office with other men of varying ages, and I had my worries about being a man as well. And so I thought I would do a bit of a scam job by doing what big men did, and to fit in to be a man as well. And that's how I was introduced to drinking. And in this cable office there were men of varying ages, and I gravitated towards the older men, and they would leave this cable office late at night because we were doing shift duties. And that's why I was away from the family, staying with relatives in town. And so I would join these men at night, and we'd go up to the red light district in Barbados and we'd drink. And for about 6 months I had this great feeling that I was accepted, because they always came back, and next morning at the cable office we would go in and they'd talk about, you know, there's this young man, he'd been with us drinking all night, and here he is now in here sending telegrams all over the world. And that was how I felt appreciated. But I only had about 6 months of that when the bottom fell out. And just simply, I didn't have much of a tolerance. I really shouldn't have drunk alcohol at all. You know, I began to collapse while they were drinking together in these, well, terrible places that we were drinking. And after a time, they'd put me in a car until we were ready to go home, and then, you know, off we'd go. But then after, I became a bloody nuisance, because these men went out to drink at night, and I was falling on the floor, and they were just carting me around like a sack of potatoes. So they did not invite me anymore with them. So I experienced my first feelings of rejection. Nobody wanted me. But it didn't matter, because I knew where they drank, and I would leave work, the cable office there in St. Lawrence Gap. It's a great hive of activities these days in Barbados, but in those days it was just a huge cable office on the beach where all the submarine cables came in. And so I got the taxi down to town, and I headed to the same areas. So when I got there, they'd see me coming, they'll move away. But it didn't matter, because all I wanted to drink, because once I got the drink, you know, I was all right. So coming from this nice, respectable family that I came from, and being seen coming out of these places at 6 o'clock in the morning, word would get back to my family, because it's a little island. And as I said, with that respectable, the son of the headmaster. And I was confronted with this from my family. No, we hear that this and that. I said, no. It wasn't me. And genuinely, I didn't believe it was me either. And so I said, no, it wasn't me. So I wasn't brought up to tell lies. But then lies made my life much easier. Because then every weekend I'd go back to the family and fit in again. But then I'd be off on the razzle during the week. So that was how I monitored on for a little while, until things got a bit pretty rough. I mean, my mother's illness in the latter stages, you know, of the systemic sclerosis, she had to be in a hospital in town. And I could see her every morning before I went to work, because the others were in the country. But every morning before I did the little job, by then I'd worked my shift to work from 11 until 7. Because being a disgrace, everybody goes to work around about 7, 8 o'clock in the morning. And if I'm out and about then, you know, they could embarrass you, so on and so, it'd come so. But if I arrange to work 11 till 7, by 11 o'clock, 10 o'clock when I'm going to work, everyone would be at work already. They didn't see me. And then they'd be on their way home between 4 or 5 back home. And I leave work at 7, it's dark, and no one could see me. So and I could head back to the dives that I drank in, no trouble. And but it meant my mother being in this hospital, I could go and visit her before I went to work on the mornings. And I go and see that poor woman, and I tell her, well, mommy, don't worry. You know, I'm saying my present, you know, because of the, I was brought up that way, you know, and God will heal you and so on. And she'd look at me and tell me, yes, Dudley, yes, I understand all that. But look, at she said, it's 10 o'clock in the morning and you're smelling of drink. And the truth was, I had begun to use alcohol. Because if I went to see that woman in the morning without any couple of shots in me, I would have burst into tears. So I was using, helping me to face up. And that was my predicament. Now, soon after that, my mother died. And the morning she died, I begin to use alcohol. If I saw anything coming terrible, I'd blot it. Blot, because those blackouts then were to my advantage. If I didn't want to see anything, I'd just step up the intake and I'd black out completely. And this, a week before I saw she was on the turn for the worse, and I stepped up my intake, and for a week I never drew a sober breath. Never emerged. And you know, you can drink like a dog, as I did. And just the Saturday, the Sunday morning, I got up again, and I was lying in a gutter in the same red light district, you know, in an alleyway. My trousers, you know, they stuffed your bunnies in different crevices, but the people that, you know, picking your pockets in those places knew where to look. So there I was lying in the gutter, and I got myself together and got a taxi and went home about 6 o'clock in the morning. And I couldn't enter through the front, so I came through the back, the side door. My grandmother was preparing something, and she saw me coming. And you know, when you sleep in the gutter in the tropics, you know, it's green slime, so you can see it quite easily on you. And she said, oh my God, Dudley, don't let your mother see you like that, because you'll only send her before she's ready to go. So I crept in and down the passage, and the bedroom window where she lay, door was open, so she could see. And she turned in the bed and she saw me. And that was the last thing my mother saw. An hour later, the woman died. Now, I don't say that as an achievement, but that's the truth of my life. I went to work at the same cable office, and they said, oh, you're needed back at home. When I got home, the woman was dead. So that woman, that's the last thing she saw before, an hour before she died. Now, my amends to that woman is staying sober on a daily basis, because I couldn't make amends directly to her. So that's how I wanted to get away from everything. I had been to an AA meeting in Barbados, and I heard a man talking about, my name is Zul Zelinka, and I've been drinking for 25 years, and now I'm in AA, and how wonderful life is. And I thought, my goodness, what's wrong with this man? I've only just had a couple of years knocking at this stuff, and he wants me to stop now, you know? But the truth was, in a couple of years after that, I nearly died from drink. So I came to this country in 65, and I thought, well, I'd try and pull myself together. And that's how I went to my first, I made a phone call or something. But anyhow, I was introduced, sent to this first London, because in those days I was living not far from King's Cross. I got a little hovel of a room in King's Cross, you know, and I went just along the Euston Road to the first London meeting, and that's when I met Shetland John, and he welcomed me and so on. And he took time, because he took my details and so on as a personnel. And a few weeks later, he wrote to my father in Barbados, you know, wrote a letter to him, I met your son, Dudley, and so on, he's in, you know, hopefully. And a nice letter to my father. And this is the thing that I remember these old timers, because they did things like that. Wrote to my father and told him how hopefully things would work. And anyhow, I soldiered on for a little while, coming to meetings and so on, and things went on. But I never really drew a sober breath, because although I went around to many meetings in London, you know, I did not hear what I wanted to hear. That's how it is. Because in those days, you know, AA wasn't as it is today. There were men who talked about, you know, just keep away from drink, you'll be all right. If you're a horse thief and you're a sober horse thief, you'll be much more successful as a horse thief. And that may sound funny to you, but that's what they did believe in. And so on, when they talked about, you know, I would say, God, I went A few weeks ago, I went to a meeting, a 50-year anniversary meeting at Toynbee Hall. And I remember going to that meeting in the depths of my despair, loved the same panel rooms. And they say, well, look, if you've got a higher power, leave him at the door. You can pick him up on your way out. But they had no call for it. Now, different kettle of fish now. So I wandered around London. I tried this. I went to different. I was on one occasion, I went to someone who recommended that I go and see a doctor at the Maudsley Hospital, and Dr. Griffith Edwards, and I did. And he arranged that I could be put into a hostel for men, other alcoholics. And I went along, run by the Helping Hand organization in Grove Park in Camberwell. I went and I was admitted. And I went in there for about a few weeks. And after that, you know, I broke out on the drink again, on the razzle. And I just couldn't get free. So he went back. He said to me, well, they were putting me into the hospital in Gradingwell, into alcoholic unit. And there I was. I went to him, and he said to me in the Maudsley Hospital, he said, yes, Mr. Hart, what you need is a change in personality. And for the first time in my life, I thought, well, this man knows what he's talking about. I don't need AA. I need a change in personality. And I will go to my last AA meeting and tell them where they could stick AA. And I got on the 141 bus, top of Denmark Hill, and I went down to the nearest meeting, which is Lambeth North. And for the first time in my life, I ran up the steps of an AA meeting because it was going to be my last. And the meeting would go wrong, and they'd say, well, yes, what has the new member got to say? And then it would, then I'd deliver my party piece. And so, as I ran up the steps, I met this lady. She said to me, hello, she said, I have not seen you in AA before. I said, yes, yes, and you probably wouldn't be seeing me in AA again either. So she offered me a cigarette. I said, no, please, no, I've just put one out. The truth, I hadn't smoked for the week because I had run out of money and everything. But if I had taken a cigarette, I would have to talk to her, you see. So anyhow, she tried to, I said, please. And she went away. And then she came and sat at the top table and she spoke. And for the first time in my life in coming to AA, the woman spoke. And it was like water on parched earth. The woman described exactly how I was feeling inside. And she spoke, you know, and that woman had a terrible story. She was chucked out of Wallingham Park with the same Dr. Max Glatt was in charge of it. And a little doctor from Yorkshire, Martin, you know, when she was chucked out, took her out in a wheelbarrow and laid her by the side of the road to get a bus back into London. But that woman had a writer, and you know, but anyhow, this is the same woman, and she was 7 years sober at the time. And she spoke about this disease and how when you get sober the AA way, the world is your oyster. And how, you know, this is it, this is the way. And she talked about a sort of sobriety. It wasn't the sort of sobriety, said, well, you know, maybe tomorrow I could get drunk or something. Nothing like that. She spoke with a certain amount of certainty that if you did this thing, it would work. And that's what I wanted, some certainty, to be sure. Because I was one of those people that think, well, yes, it would work, but it probably wouldn't work for me. But the woman spoke with a certain amount of certainty that I my ears pricked up. And then she said, yes, when you work this AA program, you know, you undergo this change in personality. And by God, I thought, well, that's what the doctor said this morning. Change in personality. So at the end of the meeting, I couldn't say a word. And after the meeting, I went up to her. I said, look, I am very, very sorry. I treated you so badly. I said, but I am confused. I said, this morning, Dr. Edwards told me that I need a change in personality. And now you're talking about this change in personality. And I followed that woman home. And thank God it was 1965. Not these days. She would probably call the police. But I followed that woman home. She was living just off in Manchester Square, number 33. And I followed that woman all the way from Lambeth up. And she said, "But haven't you got?" And I followed that woman home, and she explained to me. And then I went back, because I refused to go back to South London where I was staying. But that was the beginnings of everything for me. Because I had told her that the doctor was getting me to this alcoholic unit. And, you know, she said, "Well, look, that's the best place for you. You go. And when you leave that unit, you must come back to London to a meeting that I'm starting, because you will get the real therapy of AA in this meeting. Because there's all sorts of things. There are few people doing this thing," she said, "you know, working this program, you know, to get yourself well from alcoholism. But I'm starting this group called the Akron Group. And, you know, a few of us are going to get together, started, and then you can come back and you can get well in this group." So I went to Gwellingwell and stayed in this hospital for 3 months in those days, and did my life story, as like everyone else. And, you know, everybody, poor old dad and so on, when they fellow patients, and the doctor in those days, the doctor, Rathod, said to me, read the story, he said, "Well, you know, all these people," sisters in sympathy, he said, "but look," he said, "you know, you've got a brain on in you." And she said, "You must decide whether you're going to use that brain that you've got," he said, "or if you want to drink," he said, "because if you want to drink, it'll be better to go back to Barbados and die in the warm than to die in the cold." That's what he told me. And I was, you know, I was free from alcohol for 3 months. I thought to me, this is a fucking up. You know, this man, you know, he deals with sick people, so he gets sick too, you know. Yeah. And he must be, you know, I would be cynical like that as well, you know. So I forgave him because I realized where he was. And, you know, instead of coming back to London, and I hope that you can edit this tape, you can take that bit out. I went back. I stayed around Bognor Regis, not far from Chittister, where we were. And she kept telling me, "Come back, Dad, I'm starting this group and you can get involved in it." I said, no, it's all right, because here I was by the sea. It was lovely. And then, you know, I reached that point where I always did. And I was doing a job, working at nights and so on, paying lots of money, working at night, and not sleeping very well during the day. And I broke out on the drink. I reached that point and said, "What's the use?" And I had a drink. And then the bottom fell out for poor old Dad. Within a week, I was sleeping on a bus, under a bus shelter there in Bognor Regis, in my brand new dog hung stool suit that I'd bought, you know. And that was the beginning of the end for poor old Dad. Drifted back to London. And, you know, nobody, nothing, and so on. Didn't go to AA. And I was on the tramp. And by that I mean, and here I was, 22. On the tramp, living rough, sleeping in hedges. I'd go to the same meet if I did go anywhere and find a nice hedge to sleep in during the night. And that's how I try to exist. And not even an overcoat, just a suit. And that's how, you know. And I lived in some very, very bad places, Salvation Army hostels and so on. And I really got very, very bad, because there was a man called Ian Robertson, a member of the fellowship. He had been in that hostel with me. And he met me one day in Blackfriars Bridge, because I was staying in the Blackfriars Salvation Army hostel. And what I used to do would be just on mornings after I'd had my breakfast of a cup of tea and some baked beans on toast, I would then walk all along that Blackfriars Road along the bridge, and I would beg, you know, if I met people from anywhere near the West Indies, I would meet up to them and talk to them and slowly ask them for a couple of shillings to get back to where I was staying, and they'd give me. And all I needed in those days, I was drinking cheap wine, 2 bottles of cheap plonk would keep me in Cloud Cuckoo Land. And you're not eating and just drinking this cheap red wine. And my health deteriorated. And this man met me on Blackfriars Bridge one day, and he said, "Oh, Dudley, he said, come, he said, you're in awful state. He said, come with me, he said, and he took me to Victoria, got on the tube, took me to Victoria. He said, and he took me to a hotel, and he said, look, you stay here for 2 days, because Dr. Edwards was in America on some conference. If when he comes back, I'm going to get you in the hospital. He said, but don't leave, stay. He paid for 2 nights with me. I'll come back for you. He came back for me, and he took me up to the Maudsley Hospital, and they had me admitted to St. Francis, just up the hill, the sister hospital. And then I collapsed completely. I don't know what. And when people ask me, when did you stop drinking, I couldn't tell you. Because all I know is that some weeks later, I woke up, I was in agony and pains, you know, because I had a type of pneumonia when you're dehydrated and you nearly die. And then I woke up, they'd give me some pills, some tetracycline, but I found out later, to kill this pneumonia. And I woke up and I heard these explosions and fireworks going off. And that's how I know that I was. And I was in that hospital bed in a medical ward. And there were 33 people in those beds. And all for that, when I first woke up, they were just falling on the floor. They were opening their chests and massaging their hearts and carting them out. Half of them were carted out. And I was in bed number one, which is usually the one next to the stairs. You expect that man to die, so he's the first man out, rather to disturb the others. One poor man who was next to me was dying from something in his throat, and he was strangling. I remember the sister took me, sent me down to the other end. He said, well, this man did it. But that's the ward I was in, and it was then in that ward that I did the first step. You know, because I remembered, I said, God, please help me to get back to an AA meeting. And I was in that hospital, and the first person, I don't know how the word gets around, but the first man that came to that hospital to visit me was a man, the same man, Shetland John. And he came in, and he said to me, you know, Dudley, 7 years ago, I came to this very hospital to see a man, and his name was, what was his, Tracy. He was an Irish, a guardsman. I can't remember his name now. An Irish guardsman. He was a member of the Irish Guard. Big, tall man. If I see him ahead of me, and he said, "Jesus, Seamus Tracy." That's right. Yeah. And he said, "And he's sober today." And the same thing can happen to you. And the other man that came to see me was a man called Falklands Peter. And he came to me. And he brought a copy of the big book. And he said to me, he said, Dudley, I know isn't much you can focus on and so on. He said, but the thing that will save your life is this. He said, because a few of us are doing it. And this is what you need. This will save your life. And he opened it to the fifth chapter. He said, please, if it's anything you do understand, this is going to save your life. And that, he said, try and read what you can. So that's how I was introduced to the fifth chapter. Because he told me, Dudley, as long as you live, you know, you will never, ever say to anybody that you don't know how AA works, but it works. You will know how it works, because this is what you've got to do to get well. If you're a chronic alcoholic like me, and you are, he said. And word got back to this lady that I told her I met that night, that Dudley is in South London in an awful bad way, and I was down to like skin and bone. And she said, well, told the person, well, that young man will have to come to me, but I'm not going anywhere near him. He must come to me. And so I struggled. I didn't have anywhere to go. They put me to halfway house, not far from the hospital, when I left. And I left that hospital with a suitcase full of rags and a broken alarm clock. And that's how I went to this other place, and I began to put myself together. And when I went to this halfway place, which is in St. Francis Hospital, they held an AA meeting. And that was the first meeting that I went to in St. Francis Hospital. And I was glad to be there. And after a time I got my strength, I did go back to the meetings in center of London. And I walked into this meeting and the lady was there. And she said to me, "Now, how are you?" I told him, "Well, not too bad." She said, "Well, you can put it like that." So she said to me, "I can see you've been having a pretty rough time." I said, "Yes, I did." She said, "You know, I would love to help you. But I have to help you on one condition," she said, "because this is the problem with you. You nibble, you go away and have a little thing." She said, "And I can't help you like that. The only way I am prepared to help you," she said, "is if you do put your life in my hands for 2 years and just do what I tell you to do. If you want to do what you want to do," she said, "then go now. The reason for that is," she said, "I don't want to start helping you. You nibble and die, because I couldn't forgive myself as long as I live. So I want you, if you want me to help you, just put your life in my hands. Trust me," she said, "and we can work together." And as I knew, I could not have another drink again. And I put my life in that woman's hands. And she put me back together again. Now, the woman, as I told you, was pretty serious and rigorous about this thing. She was just like me, a chronic alcoholic, you know, who nearly died from this stuff. She got her in moment of lightning, because after being chucked out of Warringham Park Hospital, she was admitted to St. Bernard's, and she had a spiritual awakening there. And the woman got back and so on, had a tremendous sobriety. And she knew this disease like the palm of her hand. And so we began. The woman would allow me, every Wednesday we would meet in that little 33 Manchester Square. And she would go to that church in Brantford Street there, that little church, to 6 o'clock Mass. And after the Mass at 6:30 or whatever it was, we met there, and then we got down to business. You talk about taking through the steps, you know. Everything was looked after. I used to wear a top plate, in fact, I still do. And my last bout of drinking, I had puked it down the toilets in Holborn Police Station. And so, you know, for a long time, I didn't have any top teeth, and she would always say, "Well, you know, you must get your teeth organized, you know, because once you get them organized, then they'll get you to speak for me," and she couldn't understand a word I was saying, you know. And she would always tell me, "Well, get your teeth fixed," and so on, about anything. And then once she got so mad with me on one occasion, she went to some dentist not far away and came back with magazines with just teeth in it, you know. And I came in the evening and said, "Yes, there's some magazines for you to read." And every one of them, teeth, 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 teeth. And so she said, "Yes, go and get your teeth fixed." And that's how it began with me. But she explained everything to me. And most of all, she had this sort of sobriety that I wanted. I wanted that certainty. I wanted to know that I didn't have to drink again. Didn't have to drink. And she believed that if you got sober the AA way, the drink had no part to play in your life. Drink had no part to play in your life. And you become the real human being that you were meant to be in the first place. And so everything has to be sorted out. And so that's how we began to work. And I would have loved her brain to be transplanted into mine. You know, it would have saved me a lot of trouble. But the next best thing I did was to sit and listen to that woman and do everything that she did. Now, this may sound a bit silly to you, but it made a lot of sense to me in those days. She had one of those little alarm clocks, the Big Ben. And I got one too. And I still have that thing in my trunk somewhere all these years later. But I wanted it, you know, to, when I look at that, it reminded me of the warmth and so on. It was significant. I copied everything that woman did. And that's how we began. I got involved in that group that she was started, and somebody mentioned that group in Great Chapel Street that they said the Lord's Prayer. And the reason why I know why they said the Lord's Prayer, and they still do in Ireland. They say them at the end of meetings. But when AA first started out, they wanted to say something, join together. At the end of the meeting, the idea was to join together and say something that everybody would know. And that's why the Lord's Prayer was chosen, because everybody more or less knows the Lord's Prayer. Yes, we use the Serenity Prayer in this country, but that was why the Lord's Prayer was used, not that it was anything to do with God. It was just something that we could all say together before we departed. And so, yes, we did start with the Lord's Prayer, and I got involved in that group. But working this program, you know, one I did on that hospital bed when I got back, came to believe Paul granted me, could restore me to sanity. Yes, I grew up as an acolyte. I knew God. I knew the ritual of prayer. You know, I knew it. I knew when to move up and raise the priest's vestments, when he raised the host. I knew that, the ritual. But it didn't mean that I was anywhere close to God. And that's the point, because I realized, you know, that, and having sinned as I did, because although I drank in those red light districts, you know, I was young and stupid and inexperienced, and God knows lots of things happened to me that I hadn't planned, you know. And so I realized I had thought I had turned from God, had sinned, you know, some of the worst sins you can imagine. That was poor old dad. So I couldn't go back as I was, you know, although I would have hoped that I could be washed in the blood of the Lamb. It wasn't that, because I was responsible. And I had to deal with these things. And so I began to work on this one. I knew it was a God, different relationship. And so I understand then that God was working through the group that I was attending. And here was somebody with that arrogance, you know, that I grew up and I knew about, good Christian family and so on. And I had that feeling that God would deal with me directly, you know. I would get one of those bolts in the blue, like Saul of Tarsus. But you see, God deals with people, honest people, that way. But alcoholics of my type are basically dishonest, you know. We cannot see the truth, or nor do we want to see it. We can't see the truth. So God has to come to us through this way. And that is how it works. That triangle you see above me is the eternal triangle. That's what it means in AA. It is God, a self, and a human being. And that's why we must always come to AA meetings. That's what, you see, this is not new. This is not what I discovered. This is what she told me. We must always come to an AA meeting to establish that triangle, the contact, you know, God, yourself, and your fellow being. And when you clock into that, you know, when you clock into that, you will get the strength that you need for the week or however long it is until you get back to an AA meeting, because that is how God is going to work with you. And that's why you can't stay away from AA and survive if you are an alcoholic and give yourself to this program, because that's how it will always work. And she told me, you know, 7 days, I must promise her that 7 days must never pass without me darkening the doors of an AA meeting, as she put it. And the point is this, that sometimes in life you may not be able to darken the doors of an AA meeting. And I knew what she meant later in life. Because I was able later in life to work miles away from nowhere in the midst of the African bush. Because I want some of the benefits I got from the fellowship, but that I became an engineer and geologist. And I worked on projects, you know, for this government and the British government and other governments as well, in the bush, and I'd be miles away from an AA meeting. But even although I was in the bush, you know, there'd be drums beating and people blowing up all sorts of stuff. Alcohol is available wherever you go. And that's why sometimes at night, after my slogging, working on different things and making measurements during the day, at night in my tent, I will be a little lamp reading something about AA. And that's the point. Wherever you are, if you can't get to a meeting, you must pull some AA literature out and make that contact by reading it, because you're still in communion with your fellow alcoholics, even by reading the literature. It is not if you can physically get to a meeting, you should make that contact, but if you're miles away, you can't. So to come back to where I was working with this lady, began to understand, and she told me the 4-step, you know, you had to write things down. Write it down. Write it down. And don't put any spin on it or this or that or interpret it. Just write all that nonsense down. Write it down as it comes out. Write it down. Write it down. Just let it come out. Because you will get some order to it when you sit down and tell another human being exactly who you are. And you know, she told me, you know, Dad, she believed that a man should do the fifth step with a man and a woman with a woman. And it's as simple as that. She said, and you know, God will send the person for you to do your fifth step with. You just keep writing it down. And I did just that. I was working in a little job in those days down on the Old Kent Road. And she rang me one evening. She said, Dad, the gentleman you're going to do the fifth step is in the country. And you're going to a meeting tonight. And after the meeting, he's agreed to do the fifth step with you. Now, I hadn't seen this man from the man in the moon. And I said, but she said, but what? She said, you know, I told you from the beginning. If you don't do what I tell you to do, the bet's off. That's it. The end of it. And I said, well, all right. So I went to this meeting in the same Great Chapel Street. And this big brute of a man, huge brute of a man, Canadian, Joe, spoke. And here was a man who was in Canada and locked up for life. You know, he hit a man one night in the red light district in Canada. And he fell over, hit the back of his head and died. So he was locked up, you know. And he got sober the airway. And as a result, you know, wonderful sobriety and release. And even although you're on parole, he traveled the world carrying this message, you know, but he had his other business interests and so on. And this was the man that she chose to me to do my fifth step with. And I was terrified. And we went. After the meeting, there was a lady, and she is a lady today. She's married to a lord now. I'm not going to remember the fellowship. And she'd given up her flat for the night for us to do this thing. And she went and stayed with my sponsor that night. And me and this man went down to the flat in Pimlico, somewhere around there. Can't remember. And I never forget it because there were some cane bottom chairs that we sat in. And I come from my grandfather's people are joiners and made beautiful mahogany furniture with cane back chairs and so on. I remember, it reminded me of that. Anyhow, we sat down and there was a sandwich and so on. And I had my notes, all these things written down. And I, you know, as I was journeying down to this place, I was thinking, well, I'll tell him this, I'll tell him that and so on. And, you know, because he might not understand, you know, coming from Canada, and you know, and I had my reservation. So we went into this flat of hers. And the man threw off this great coat that he had, you know. And he rolled up his sleeves, and one of his arms was just as big as my body in those days. And I thought to myself, by God, you see, if I don't tell him the truth, he'd beat the shit out of me as well. And I was terrified, you know. And he told me many years later, he said, your eyes were out like organ stops, you know. And after he rolled his sleeves up, you know, I just blurted everything out. I blurted everything out, you know, because, you know, he had form. He hit a man already. And I was terrified. And he saw it in me. And I told him exactly what I had done. And this is the thing about the fourth step, right? The fifth step. Very liberating. I told that man exactly who Dudley was. And at the end of it, he didn't say to me, well, Dad, I've been around, I've seen lots of things, but you get the biscuit. He didn't say that. That man looked me full in the eyes, and he shook my hand and told me about things. And he welcomed me when he shook my hand to the human race. Now, you see, people go to the priory and all these places, treatment centers. You know, these treatment centers are just places where you have a good, comfortable way to do the fourth and fifth steps. That's what they are. And that's why they recommend you go to AA afterwards. Because they know their function, fourth and fifth steps. But you can do that in the fellowship. Because even although I was given the opportunity in Grayling, well, I didn't appreciate it, didn't know it. But that's all it was. And so people that go to these treatments come on and get stuck into air and do well. but you do it. But the point of doing the fourth and fifth step is that you, for the first time in your life, you get an insight of who you are. And that's what sobriety is all about. Understanding who you are. And when you understand who you are, you can understand and you can live. You can live without having to recourse to drink. Because that's the only thing wrong with us. As alcohol, that we cannot handle drink. Nothing else. Nothing else is wrong with us that we can't deal with. That's the point. I'm not saying we have all other issues, yes. But the only thing that we can't handle is drink. And with that knowledge and understanding of yourself on a daily basis, you can move forward with a certain amount of certainty that that woman had in life. That you know we don't need to have recourse to drink. It has no part from that moment on to play in our lives. We become free. And that's what true freedom is, you know. Freedom is that we don't have recourse to drink. That's the only thing wrong with us we can't do. Now, I am an individual, you know, I too, my own personal way, I do believe that the only thing wrong with me that I can't deal with is alcohol. The rest I can handle. And for that reason, you know, I have never told people that I work for I'm an alcoholic. Just know me deadly, and deadly does not drink. That's all they need to know. And, you know, it's a blessing that God puts in their way. I remember sometimes you work with people and they think, you know, that you know, everything you say, you know, he doesn't drink, but you know, you can slip a drink on him and he would, yeah, and he was the life and soul of the party. And I would go to their Christmas dinners. On one occasion, somebody thought they'd have a vodka. I'd take whatever it was and they put a thing on my drink. But the good Lord, because before I went to any of these functions, I would say a prayer, ask God, please, I'm leaving home sober now. Bring me back to this room sober. And he does look after you, because the drink was spiked and so on. I picked it up and I could smell the alcohol and I put it down. And you know what? I got up, because that was the point, the middle of the thing. I got up, chucked it out of the window, put my coat on and went home. They didn't try that one with me out, because that was when I left the party, you know. Because I don't please, you know, even to people that I did work with and so on. You know, I'm not there to please. I am there to do my job. I want to be paid just as cut no quarters with me. I want my fair crack of the whip, and that was it. The only thing I don't do is drink, full stop. And so I go on. Now, we begin by doing the fourth and fifth step. You know, when I really drop anchor in AA, for the rest of my life, this is where I'm going to be. And so, you know, it never bothered me about meetings and so on. Whether I come in, I've been asked to do something, I'd do it. I'd do it to the best of my ability. If the room was packed to the rafters, I would do the same thing. Because that's what it's all about. You know, and you ask the God of your understanding to help you on a daily basis. And this is what I was meant to be doing today of all days. And so nothing phases Dudley. I am content with that. And so somebody said things got better for Dudley. And for a long, long time, as I went to AA, we went on. After a time, she said, we had done the fourth and fifth steps. She said, we've got to make amends now. And who do you owe money to? And I really didn't owe to the best of my. And then I remembered that I'd borrowed some money from my father to fly to this country. Oh, she said, then you have to go and pay it. So, in those days, you know, I wasn't working much, so she said, well, do you have to do some extra work? And I used to do, although I was working this little job in the old Kent Road, I did an extra job as a kitchen porter, round about the Moisson Hotel, something like that. I used to do a little kitchen on Saturdays and Sundays to put together the money to pay my father as he returned his money. And after it, I got the fare and everything ready, so she said, okay, though. And that was, she said, well, wish me luck as I went now to Barbados. And I went to Barbados, and my father, you know, had been sober a few years. And I told him, well, you know, I've come back to pay you the money that you gave me, that we had from you for the thing. Oh, he said, Dudley, no, don't be silly. He said, you know, I'm so happy to see you as you are. No, I couldn't. I said, well, Daddy, I said, look, if you want me to get any better, you have to take it. And reluctantly, he took it. And I came back to England. And she didn't even say good morning, good afternoon. She said, did you give him his money? That's a different thing. And I said, yes. Good, she said. And that was it. Because they're amends, you know. And then you make amends like that. You direct amends in some cases and so on. And as a little young man, like I hadn't done much. And so on. Then a few years after that, I went over to Canada. My brother had gone to Canada, and where he still lives to this very day. And in a few weeks, I'm going to play some golf with him. But my brother went over to see him and so on, like that play, and sit down and talk to him. And he said, you know, Daddy, it's all for you to, all right for you to apologize and so on. He said, but my problem, he said, I'm sorry, I wasn't more charitable to you. That's what he said, you know. And this is put right. My eldest sister, you know, was the difficult one, because there's always one. No matter what I did, you know, I'd go back to Barbados and so on. She would still have that such. It took 35 years before she did trust me. Because she would always throw something back at me. I'd be there for about 2-3 weeks. And then, you know, in the midst of something, she'd tell me, you know, you said such a thing when you were drunk. And that was, God knows, you know, but it was there. And it's only then, after about 35 years, she seemed to resolve. But the point I make about that is, it's very difficult for people sometimes to forgive us what we've done. But give it time, and they've got to prove it by your actions and how you live. They will see the change in you. But you've got to give it time. Nobody's going sometime, you know, probably accept straight. You've got to keep at it. And so there we are. But I go on, and as I said, nothing much happened to me after a time. I got involved in the meetings and so on. And I tell you, steps 1 until 9 are the practical things we do to get sober. And it's not that we repeat step 5 and all these things. We do on a daily basis in 10, 11, and 12. 10, 11, or 12 are, it's the way that the program is put together, that you repeat 1 to 9, but on that daily basis within that. Not that we're making that step back, as some people think we go back. No, we continue to take these things and make that contact. The important is that conscious contact with the God of our understanding. Very, very important and sustaining in us, because, as I said, we realize where that is coming from, the God of our understanding. And you know, it is important. It's important to have a God of your understanding. Now, my sponsor had a man, and I'm not going to mention his name. Lovely, well, in his way, you know, but he always said that, you know, there comes a time in the life of alcohol when he needs that power. The only thing stands between him and the drink is a power greater than himself. And although he said it and preached it, and I got it from him, it never kept him sober, because he died from drink. But that's the point, you know, that we do need that power that will sustain us and hold us on. But as I say, I for a little while, nothing much happened to poor old Dad. Nothing happened. I just attended meetings and working, and I got a little job. You know, I tried to work in accounts in those days. Here was a nice three-piece suit, Farmer Airport, just off the Edgware Road. And I went one day, and it made me redundant. And I was shattered, because here I was doing the right stuff, and I'd been made redundant. And I crossed down through Regent's Park to head back along to Albany Street. And as I was walking, I met my sponsor in Regent's Park walking the landlady's dog. And she looked at me, she said, Dudley, what on earth has happened now? You know, because she'd seen me through all sorts of crises. And I said, well, I got made redundant. And she laughed. And there are a couple of occasions that she nearly died, and that was one of them, because I would have punched her lights out, you know. Because she didn't understand what I was going through. She laughed. She said, Dad, you don't know. God is moving you in a different direction. Trust it. She said, trust him. Trust him. He's moving in a different direction. And so 2 months later, I got a job working in the post offices in the West End of London, around Baker Street and so on. And that was the beginning of things for me, because although it was, I said, what I had planned, it worked out that after a time, you know, we moved on from there to other things. I moved on to writing duties in the near just off Shoe Lane, a little job that, you know, we got the job done in 3 hours, and then my colleagues would sit all day long and play brag, you know. But I didn't. I began to study in my spare time, got a couple of A levels, so that when the time came, I told them, well, I'd like to leave and go to university full time, and I did just that. But that's how it is, you're out of the blue like that. And the other couple of occasions too was when I first got sober, you know, once the alcohol is removed, there's a lot wrong with us, and you don't, it comes out. And one of my problems was I was hypochondriac, you know. And in those days, if you were a doctor, my sponsor knew me, you see. And if you were a doctor and she had met you before I got to you, she would tell him you're anything, but don't let him know you're a doctor. So sometimes I meet a man, he'd say he's an undertaker. He says he's a carpenter. But if they were doctors, you know, but the idea was don't let Dudley know, because he'll only make your life a misery, because he'll come with these symptoms and so on. On one famous occasion, the same Falklands Peter, the two of them were helping me, you know. And she said to me, you know what's wrong with you? You're a bloody hypochondriac. And I was fuming. Here I am. I'm trying to be an alcoholic. I know I'm an alcoholic. I look up. And I went back to Grove Park where I'm staying, and I walked around the yard, stomped up and down. Steaming. She said, you know, I was talking to Peter only yesterday, and we both come to the conclusion that you're a bloody hypochondriac. And I thought to myself, here I am. I'm telling them exactly what I feel like, you know. And they don't understand. They think I'm a bloody hypochondriac. And I stormed up and steamed up around that garden for the evening, walked up and down, you know. Seething. What's wrong with them? Why are they ganging up against me? I am an alcoholic, genuine. The real McCoy. And so, I can't go to sleep. I have to. So I got on the phone to her. I said, look, all right, I have a hypochondriac. What can I do about it? She said, well, yes, come around tomorrow evening. We can discuss more of the steps that you can get involved with. And that's how it appears, because we are very peculiar people. It's the big things don't make us drink, you know, whether they go to war, whether they get in this or the politicians do that. That doesn't make us drink. It's little silly things like that. And that's why we get defeated all the time. It's the little things that niggle at us and so on and irritate us, you know. We are very, very sensitive people. Some people can have a look at you and you're wounded, you know, wounded, hurt. Now, why did that bastard look at me like that, you know? And you see things, you know? If you talk about resentments, we're justified, you know? I didn't do him anything or her, but she just won't, you know? I think she's off. You know, now you go on, you're steamed up. And the only thing that eases that anger and steam is a drink. And that's where we are defenseless. We got to be able to deal with these things. And that's why self-knowledge, when you understand where you get wound up about these things, it's a mere bagatelle. It's not that important, you know? Not that important. You have bigger things to deal with, you know? Bigger things, your head for one, you know? That's what you got to deal with. And you got to begin to move out of your head, you know? Move out of your head. Move down. Move downstairs. And, you know, then you begin to get the insight, because the God of your understanding is moving and working on you. But that is the idea, self-knowledge, understanding self, understand what really pulls your triggers. And that's how you become to be able to defend yourself, because there's always a solution. And that's the point, that we have people to check with and talk to. You know, the same Shetland John again, we come back to him. There's a man who would allow me time, he would go down to, he was a pharmacist down in Raynham. And I go down to him, and he spent money. He gave me a lovely dictionary, which I still have to this day. J.B.I. at Lawrenson as a memento. It's in my bookcase, you know. I had that thing, took it to university, although it's still probably out of date, you know, the words in it. But it was an old friend, and that's what I mean. But I go down to that man on one occasion too. he must have been pissed off with me, you know, because I'm afraid, you know, being honest. And he, you know, full of self-pity, and because that's one of our biggest fears, you know, self, me. The poor man left me in his sitting room and came back dressed in this overcoat, a brown herringbone overcoat. And he told me, you know, I lived in, this is my coat that he slept in Aberdeen in the winter in, on the streets. And you know, but when people show you things like that, you say, well, get yourself in order, you know what I mean? You think you suffered, you know what I mean? That's it. But that's not a way of, he wasn't on, can I tell you, but will you shut up, you know, or something. He just showed me, you know, you think you suffered. But you know, I was out of this. And another thing that he told me, years later, he would tell me about when he had polyps removed from inside of him. And I, in those days, young thing, well, I don't know. In fact, I didn't give it a second thought. Until a few years ago, I experienced the same thing, but it goes back. And that's why, in talking to old-timers and they tell you things, just file them away. Because you may have to use them later on, you know? Because the same thing happened to me. And you know, it can be very, very... you know, we are mortal and so on, these things happen, but we have to be able to understand where they are. And depending on a power greater than yourself is the thing that helps you through these things. But it's all a process of learning, attending meetings and listening and sticking with the people that have been. I heard somebody mention earlier about getting into these relationships, you know, which are a waste of time. Believe you me, you can't come in here, and we are all dysfunctional. That's why we are in here. So you would hardly find Mr. or Mrs. Right in here. You might read Mr. or Mrs. Dysfunctional. That's what you get. And they've got to be really on a good program to be able to relate with them. Otherwise than that, you're pissing in the wind. It's a waste of time. It's a waste of time. As I said, you proceed outside, because then it might normal people, because then you might be stand a better chance. But in here is dysfunctional. I've been protected in many ways, you know, and I've always kept my AA that way, because I've always had the dread that if you got involved in a set of circumstances and you think, well, I can't go to that meeting because X or Y would be in there, you know, so that was, I didn't want that. So that's why I kept AA, as I said, as it is, so that there's no reason why I can't open the door and come in. Because that's where my life depends. I've got to be able to come in. And so on, fine. But a lot of people get in there, which bog them down. And then they got confused about AA. And God knows they may not be able to stay with us. But deadly serious business. Even when I first came in, you know, 3 out of 10 would survive from this disease. And that remains the same. Because lots of people come in and they go. And they never get back. And so... you know, you've got to be able to help people. And you know, if you are in here, make sure that you stay here. And you've got to come and attend and give something back. Now, I am not one of these people who can go in the highway hedges in the middle of the night and dig them out of this and that and carry the message. I carry the message in regular attendance and making a contribution. That is how it, and you know, you've got to accept these things. I mean, yes, there's a man that happened, got as far as the fifth step, and then he went off to Africa. He's been out there for the last 3 years. But hopefully when he comes back, I hope in one piece we could probably continue. But then again, we will take that one as it comes. But the point is this, that whenever you help anybody, you're helping yourself. And you know, the objective, as I told him, you know, at the end of this all, as long as I stay sober, it will be a success. And I'm afraid that's the brutal, that's the selfish thing about this program. You know, you have to, you always remember that you're doing it to save your life. And that's why if even one person remain in this room, it'll have to be the same show from me. Because it's for my benefit, you know, because I'm talking to myself. And as I said that way, you know, you keep reiterating, you know, that this is it. And so I have had, you know, life got better for me. I went back into full-time education, and then I, you know, I've had troubles just as I was unemployed. I went to university, came up, couldn't get a job, and then I'll never forget the same doctor from helped my sponsor out in the wheelbarrow, became a very good friend of mine, because we found out on one occasion he was back in Warringham Park. We went up to see him, visit, lovely man, very good friend of mine. And as I say, he said to me, you know, there must be a job for a decent man to do in England. But then out of the blue, I saw this job advertised in the Guardian for a job in Zimbabwe just after independence. And I went out and worked there for 3 years. Loved the three happy years, you know. I was working with embankment dam construction for the government, and I was lovely. I landed there on a day there that was working. I was at the AA meeting, got involved in it. Loved the AA people. And I was in this meeting in Harare. On one occasion, one night, the Tocket headquarters, was a Wednesday night meeting, and you know, the other people, visitors coming. This young lady came, and she was over from Ireland, and she contributed for the meeting and said what she had to say. At the end of the meeting, I went over to her. I said, look, I said, I know you're from Ireland, and I know who your sponsor is. She said, she laughed. I said, yes, Mary B. And the woman nearly fell flat on her face. She said, how do you know that? I said, she was my sponsor. Because she went back to Ireland and worked at the Rutland Center, where she did a lot, famous lot of work with alcoholics. But the message was the same. I recognized it, you know, that certainty that once you got sober, the air where drink had no part to play in your life. It remains with me. That woman's voice rings, she's dead and gone, but it rings in my ear today, and that's what I wanted, you know. She said, always be with you. In, you know, in this, you practice this thing. And it's routine. It's routine. It has to come routine. You know, we must not be fear of anything. We are secure. And when we talk in terms, I find these days for me, it is important to improve that conscious contact with the God of my understanding. Yes, I have gone back to my church and various things like that, but that is by the way, because as I said, I know the ritual of prayer, and I know Christians really, believe me, it takes some understanding, even more than alcoholics, Christians, you know, but I know where my first thing is in these rooms. The God of my understanding, improving that conscious contact with the God of my understanding, and it needs meditation. Now, a few weeks ago, as I said, I had had a look inside of me and found things that had to be things, and I had asked the God of my understanding to spare me, you know, because it could have been a different outcome. And he has spared me, but I know that I must go away for a few days somewhere to thank him in a very, very deep and way, because, you know, to be honest with you, I'm selfish. I want more, you know, that's the truth of it. And you know, because I'm a hypocrite, you know, you have to go through the exercises. And I also, this year, I must go and put some flowers on my sponsor's grave. I've been trying to do it. Trying to find out exactly where in Strabane she's buried. But I need to do that. You know, it's something I need to do. But also to make that conscious, you've got to set time away for the God of my understanding, because he alone is carrying me, maintaining me, keeping me. And you know, that way I'm not fazed. I have no worries about anything. Everything is sorted as far as I'm concerned. I have a simple life. I'm retired now. I became, as I said, from Zimbabwe, I came back to this country and I got a job working for the government, which ended up me back in Africa again, this time working, and that's why I came to live in this part of the world, because all of the government laboratories are in Berkshire. They were moved out of London so that they'd save the £3,000 London waiting that they paid civil servants. So that's why we were moved out, just outside of the London waiting thing, so I had to come and move up this way. And I worked for, as I said, until the end of my life, working on projects within Africa, up and down it, and even out in Nepal, and even Central America, and so on. And for somebody, as I told you, I came in, I was on the tramp. That's the experience I've had. I went to university the second on two occasions, and I went to one of the best, for my postgraduate, one of the best universities in England, you know, for engineers that I went to, that nobody thought I would get into. And that again is due to AA. I went to the Royal School of Mines, and I'm not sitting for this interview. And the man said to me, you know, before I went to Lancaster University first, and the chap said to me, he said, Dad, you know, we're trying to get somebody in that place, but don't be surprised if you don't get into it, he said, you know, but, you know, just the roll of the drums. So I went to this interview up at the, just opposite Albert Hall, and the man said to me, oh, yes, he said, yes. So what mapping have you done? So I told him, you know, I've done this and that. He said, yes. But what mapping have you done? And I went on and on and on and on and on and on. And I'll never forget, when my back is to the wall, AA comes in, you know. So he pushes me back to the wall. He said, yes, but what mapping have you done? Oh, I said, all right, I said, you know. It said, went wrong properly, I bit it. So I said to him, I said, okay then, well, according to your standards, then I haven't done any mapping. And he smiled. And he said, I like you. I like you, he said. Now you see, I don't know, he might have his opinion of West Indians that, you know, they're putting hot on the temper, they probably throw a chair or something. I don't know if he expected me to throw a chair or something, but it surprised him. He said, I like you. And he told me, well, I give you this place. And that's how I got in. You see, because, and this is a funny thing about even in learning, if you don't know, say you don't know, and then you're told. And that's one of the big lessons I learned. And in education in this country, you can go to university or anywhere in this country, and if you think you know, and the man in the street, they know everything. If you know things, they don't tell you anything. If you say you don't know, they will tell you. And at the end of it, you would have known what you knew before what the person told you. And that's how you know. So it's always best to say, I don't know, and then you can be told. And that's how you become educated. Don't know, and then people tell you. And then you know much more than them, because you now know what they knew and what you knew before that. And that's a simple secret. But that's how I got him, because he expected me, the man in the street never likes to come up short and say they don't know. But the fact that I could say, well, I don't know, you know, and he gave me the place. And that's how the AA works. I could give hundreds, but that's one dramatic case where it worked for me. And that's why I said story. I proved it many times. Back to the wall. Rely on the AA philosophy. It is the thing that will guide you through. And so I've had this wonderful life. I went back to my land of Barbados. And just before I left, as a young man, I heard my uncle on one occasion, you know, he was talking to my grandmother, and they had no idea I was in the house. In actual fact, I was lying under the bed, because in those days I used to drink so much rum that my kidneys would be on fire. And I used to lie under the bed onto these granite tiles that would cool my back. And I heard him telling my grandmother, he said, oh my God, Mums, I came home today in the bus and I heard them talking about this disgraceful young man. And he said, you know, it hurt me to find out that they were talking about Dudley. That was my mother's brother. And 12 years ago, we went back to Barbados to bury my father. And we were, the family sitting around, he was there. And my sisters were saying, oh yeah, Uncle Bernard should be able to do the eulogy. And he turned and said, because he didn't know I heard, all those years ago, he turned and said no. He said, Dudley should do it. Dudley should do it, he said, because in the end, he turned out very much like his father. And that was one of the moments of my sobriety, made a point. You know, that's what he felt. And that same man, all those years, he never knew. I heard him say that, but that was for the thing, one of the most uplifting things I've heard in sobriety. He said, because he turned out. But the truth is, I'm not as good as my father. My father was a saint. That is the truth. But the point is, you know, and it comes back to what my sponsor said in the early days about this change in personality. We are the same jokers. We don't change. We're the same jokers. Everything is still intact and there. That is why we are alcoholics until the day we die. But the point is the way we maneuver and the way we do things. It gives people the impression that we have changed. But don't forget it. We are there. We are basically the same people, the same things, the same hurts and everything. It's there waiting, and we must be able to practice these things. And that way people don't know that they think you're a different person. And that's the thing. It's a, never mind what it is. It works. You do that, and they don't know. They don't know. That is why you must know that you are basically that. And that's why you must practice this thing. Practice, because your life depends upon it. And that is the switch. The apparent change in personality. Because we do things differently. We don't react. People can't pull our strings and we jump, you know. When they pull it, you say, well, stop pulling. And we do that. That's the point. We are no longer at their whims, and nobody can upset us because they can't. Because you know who you are. You are secure. And you can have stop doing that or so on. And you can tell people no. And mean it. You see, because we want to please people. We don't know. We say yes and no when we really mean yes and no. This is the point about being sober. Somebody's given me everything they've had in life. And, you know, I'm depending on it to help me to die. And that is why I'll forever practice this thing. Have I got much? How have I gone on? Too long now or what? No. But what you say? It has to be able to fulfill all aspects of my life. And I'm depending on it to help me to on the way out. Because most of my friends that I know died sober. You know, they died sober and content. And that's what the objective is contented sobriety. That's what we came in for. And, you know, we can have a wonderful life. I am still having it in measure. I'm off to play some, well, I normally go to Ireland in the second week in May for my usual week out in Galway Bay to eat some oysters and fish. You know, you don't have to drink. But I love the place, famous place called Moran's. You know, I like to go over there and have my life. In fact, they know I've been going there for years now. Some about 25 odd years that I've been going there every year. They know I come in May. And sometimes I go back for the Oyster Festival in September. These are good things. You don't have to love the little bits of doing. Unfortunately, the doctor steps in and stops me eating now. So, you know. There you are. When you begin to enjoy yourself, the doctor can always stop it. But fair enough, within limitations. And I'm happy and content. And as I say, you know, I hope that the same thing can happen for you. But whether my time is up or not, you know, I'm going to bring what I've had to say to a close. Now, before I go, there may be some of you here, what I've said could upset you. For God's sake, don't leave the room. Don't unknow on my account. Far from it. That's not the objective of my being here, you know. But what little, anything that I've said that makes sense, that's the thing that might be able to be important to you. Hang on to that. The rest is just a mere bagatelle. But thank you very much for listening to me. Sorry.
Okay, then, thank you, Dudley. We now have the promises.
Thomas Alcoholic. If we are painstaking about this phase of our development, we will be amazed before we are halfway through. We are going to know a new freedom, a new happiness. We will not regret the past, nor let wish to shut the door on it. We will comprehend the word serenity, and we will know peace. No matter how far down the scale we have gone, we will see how our experience can benefit others. That feeling of uselessness and self-pity will disappear. We will lose interest in selfish things and gain interest in our fellows. Self-seeking will slip away. Our whole attitude and outlook upon life will change. Fear of people and of economic insecurity will leave us. We will intuitively know how to handle situations which used to baffle us. We will suddenly realise that God is doing for us what we could not do for ourselves. Are these extravagant promises? We think not. They're being fulfilled among us, sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly. They'll always materialise if we work for them.
Thank you, Thomas. The tradition 7, back at near the door there, if you wish to make any further contribution before you leave the meeting, self-supporting, not charging entry fee. Just before I went to prayer, a reminder that our usual meeting will be taking place tonight at 8 o'clock in the main house in the refectory downstairs. You're welcome to join us if you wish. And that final little with the Serenity Prayer. Dudley, would you like to lead us out with that? And here, I believe, we're meant seated.
Yes, well, we close with the Serenity Prayer using the word God as you do or do not understand them. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Thank you.